Orville Freestone Jr., Sunday PM, August 1st, 2010.
Turn in your Bibles to the 129th Psalm. Before we read the 129th Psalm, let's again read the Psalm from last week, 128th Psalm. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. You shall eat of the fruit of the labor of your hands. You shall be blessed, and it shall be well with you. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. May you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. This is a psalm of domestic tranquility, of peace and contentment. Now, the 129th psalm, following that, is quite jarring. Let's read through it first. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, let Israel now say. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. The plowers plowed upon my back. They made long their furrows. The Lord is righteous. He has cut the cords of the wicked. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turn backward. Let them be like the grass upon the housetops, which withers before it grows up, with which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder the sheaves his arms. Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. This is quite a contrast to the 128th Psalm, which is a psalm of blessing upon a household, and then here of unremittent persecution of a people. If you have seen the film Fiddler on the Roof, I think you can appreciate this contrast between these two psalms, where in the beginning you see a poor but happy family, a normal family, although sometimes Tuvia doesn't seem quite normal, but it's a story of a large but poor family and how happy they were, and then suddenly disaster strikes and they are expelled and have to go into exile, break up families, and it was the terrible persecution that followed. That is the picture that these two psalms put together make. For Psalm 128 is a national psalm, and that's what David Barron, the noted Hebrew Christian scholar of the early 20th century, called it, about the history of Israel. And the 128th Psalm is about the happy families that wherever they were, the Jewish people were able to form and to live in the midst of constant persecution. So this 129th Psalm is Israel's testimony nationally. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, let Israel now say. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. Again, David Barron said that this is the defiant cry of the Jewish people in the face of persecution aimed to destroy them as a people. And yet, they're still a people. 40% of the Jews in the world were killed either by Russia or by Germany during World War II. And yet, throughout all of the years of modern history, which is usually deemed to be from 1500 to 2000, the population of the Jewish people has remained fairly constant. Never more than about 15 million, never less than 10 million. It's usually somewhere in between. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth. The youth of Israel as a nation, of course, was in the land of Egypt when a family grew into a tribal federation of a nationhood. And there, in the very beginning of their history as a nation, they were enslaved and persecuted and in every way measures were taken to keep their population from growing, and yet it did grow. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth. In the Old Testament, we read not just Israel, but as they wandered in the wilderness, the tribes of the desert attacked them without cause. The Midianites and various other tribes, and as they entered the Promised Land, of course, all of the Canaanite nation states were their enemies that they had to conquer. But then, as they began to form their nation in the land of Israel, the nations around about them, nations that were related to them, descended from Abraham like them, the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites, and then, of course, later the Philistines, and then Syria, and then, of course, Assyria and Babylon, and then the Greek kingdoms, and then the Romans, and they are still in the Roman dispersion to this day. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, let Israel now say. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. Millions of Jews have been killed, but the nation retains its identity and its history and its culture. And then we read some striking comparisons here. The plowers plowed upon my back. They made long their furrows. The Lord is righteous. He hath cut the cords of the wicked. They plowed upon my back. I have a volume with excerpts from the travels of a number of Europeans in the East during the 18th and 19th centuries, and three different ones of them remarked that in traveling in those Eastern lands, one of the laments of people who feel that they have been wronged, or people who feel they were persecuted, or just people who feel that they've been taken advantage of or that circumstances against them, is my back has been plowed, or they plow me up. It brings the metaphor brings to mind the beatings that were frequent in those barbaric times, of leaving welts or open cuts on a person from being beaten. They plowed their back. This metaphor is used elsewhere also in the Old Testament of the persecution of Israel. They plowed upon my back, they made long their furrows. The Lord is righteous. Now that is a remarkable statement. I have read writings by Holocaust survivors who have, many of them have said, where was God in the time of the gas ovens? And I have read writings of many of them who have claimed themselves to be atheists because of this. One of them is a contributing editor to the Denver Post. And why did God permit this? Years ago, I heard a program on the radio. That tells you how long ago it was. Between a Protestant minister and a Jewish rabbi. And this rabbi said, well, all I can say to you is, if, as you say, the Jews are God's chosen people, it doesn't pay to be God's chosen people, does it? It never pays to be God's chosen, whether Jew or Christian, if you're not going to obey him, if you're not going to follow in the way that he has revealed. That's one of the reasons why so many Christians are so unhappy and so at loose ends, is they know better, but they don't do better. But here is a remarkable statement. He said, he's relating Israel's history. They have been greatly afflicted from the very beginning. And their afflictions have been like their back being plowed or with constant beatings. But the Lord is righteous. Now that is a statement of faith when everything is going wrong. I have heard Christians complain, why would God let little children, innocent children, suffer? Why would God let this happen to me? I've heard that so often. I'm sure you have too. Why would God let this happen to me? As though God were indebted to us. And I have noticed that in most of those cases, what they were enduring was brought upon themselves, by themselves. In a sense, that's the way it was with Israel too. Why did the Midianites persecute Israel? Why, in the book of Judges, did the surrounding nations conquer them? Well, when we read the Bible, we see that the recorder of those instances said it was because they had forsaken the Lord, because they had forsaken his law. They had forsaken his covenant. And thus, this was retributive judgment. Retributive judgment is judgment that follows in due course an offense. Many of the events, many of the woes of life are just the result of what we do. And then we blame God. But the psalmist here didn't. He said, in the midst of this plea for their history, the Lord is righteous. That's a mark of faith. That's a mark of spiritual maturity to say the Lord is righteous when everything is going against you. The Lord is righteous when your world is falling apart. He has cut the cords of the wicked. This is the reason why most scholars attribute the composition of this psalm to the time after the return of the Jews from Babylon. They were looking back upon the time of their slavery, upon the time of their exile, and yet they attribute righteousness to God in all that he does, and acknowledge that it was God who cut the cords of their bondage in Babylon. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. Let them be like the grass on the housetop, which withers before it grows up, with which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder of sheaves his arms. Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. This is a prayer. May all who hate Zion be put to shame. This is a prayer for relief from their persecutions. Because even after the Jews returned from Babylon and were rebuilding Jerusalem, the same nations related to them as descended from Abraham and others who were not so related to them were doing everything they could to hurt them, doing everything they could to stop their work, and doing everything they could to form a coalition to conquer them militarily. But the Lord was with them. The Lord cut the cords of the wicked. May all who hate Zion be put to shame. Remember that statement as we proceed. Let them be like the grass upon the housetops. Again, I consulted this book that I value so much. It's about 150 years old, and it cited a number of different travelers in both Eastern Europe and in the Arab lands, and they said that in most of those countries, all of the homes and many of the public buildings were flat-roofed, and they were built in ways that we would think rather crude today, but they would put poles and branches up there because they didn't always have the timber to make it solid, and if they wanted to use the roof to recline on, as many of them did in the evening, they would use some more substantial rafters. But after they had built the roof as best they could, they would put sod on the roof, or sometimes just clay on the roof. And every time it was a hard rain, they would have to repair the roof. But if they put sod or grass on the roof, the sod would absorb most of the rain, of the light rains that they had there in the summer. And the grass would grow on the roof. But like grass in one of Jesus' parables, it had no depth of root. So it would wither in the heat of summer. So he's comparing the grass on the roof to the grain in the fields, the grain which they would harvest. And they would use the grain, and they would even use the straw to put in the clay to make clay bricks, sun-dried bricks. But let them be like the grass on the housetops, which withers before it grows up. In other words, may all that they endeavor to do not come to fruitage. May they not be able to complete what they're trying to do, in most cases trying to destroy Israel. Let them be like the grass upon the housetops, which withers before it grows up, with which the reaper does not fill his hand. When they reaped the grain in those days, it was in a very primitive way. A reaper would grab a handful of stalks, and with a sickle he would cut those stalks, and he would lay them down behind him. Then the binder would come after him and pick up as many stalks as he could, and then he would bind them into a sheaf. And then the gatherers would come behind them to carry the grain in when it was harvest, with which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder the sheaves his arms. In other words, let all that they do not come to completion. Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. This was the common, today, the common Jewish greeting is shalom, peace. And that is used sometimes in the Old Testament too. They asked after his peace, or said shalom. But apparently in the early days of Jewish or Israelite society in the Holy Land, when most of the country was an agrarian society, they had as a common greeting what the Psalms said there. In the second chapter of the book of Ruth, we read this. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite, said unto Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said unto her, go, my daughter. So she went out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come into the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. Bethlehem was only a large village in that day. But the fields that they cultivated were spread around the town. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. Aren't those beautiful greetings? The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you. But may those who would do Israel harm, those who would persecute, may people never say of them, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. And this brings us to a problem that we call imprecation, the prayer of imprecation. A prayer of imprecation is praying for retribution upon persecutors. It can even involve cursing others in the name of the Lord. But it is to praying that evil would happen to your those who would harm you or your people. And that's what they meant by a prayer of imprecation. We find this throughout the psalm, sometimes in a personal manner, but usually here in a collective manner. Those who harm Israel, may they never reap their grain. May they never prosper. May the blessings of the Lord never happen to them. And is that right? Is a prayer of imprecation right? Well, that depends. In the fifth chapter of Matthew, in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, we read, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." No, it was the rabbis who said you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, not Moses. "So that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven," that is, that you may be like him. Sons here meaning a likeness. "For he makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends the rain on the just and the unjust. But if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? But if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" So, in the teaching of Jesus, and later in the New Testament, we are to pray for our enemies, not to bring imprecation, prayers of imprecation against them, to pray evil upon them. But that's in a collective manner. The Sermon on the Mount was never meant to be a system of government. It was never meant to be implicated by governments or by society in general. The Sermon on the Mount throughout had to do with personal relationships. And Jesus was saying that we should never take out our wrath upon another person, even one who's persecuting, because God knows who is the next Saul of Tarsus, but we don't. God knows who he is, the hounds of heaven, mercy and truth, are chasing, but we don't. If we pray against a person who's harming us, we could very well be praying against what God is doing in another person. And we would show an unchristian or even an un-Jewish here attitude toward another person. But this psalm isn't praying this prayer of imprecation against persons. He's praying these prayers against the enemies of Israel, against the enemies of God. I read one time something that I've never forgotten. It says the character of a person can be known by what it is that angers them. If someone is breaking into a home and harming the occupants, is that not something to be angry about? Not something to do something about? Who we become angry with and what we become angry about displays who we are. The psalmist here was not praying for himself. He was praying for his people. Did not the Holocaust make you angry if you were old enough to remember it? Doesn't the persecution of anyone make you angry and pray against the enemies of God and against those who would do wrong? And yet, we see in Matthew 6:10 another view on this. In Matthew 6, again, we are in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with verse 7, "And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases, as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Pray then like this: Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." I shall never forget the time when I was discussing this in the Greek text with C.M. Clarenceau. And he says, "Brother Freestone, you have just read the greatest prayer of judgment that you could ever pray. Do you know what's going to happen before God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven?" Chapters 4 through chapter 20 of the book of Revelation tells you. Only after then will God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So the best way to pray when those people are harming us, when we feel they're plotting against us, or when we face evil, we don't know if God is working through that evil in the heart of someone, like the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem didn't know when Saul of Tarsus was harrying them. So the best way to pray is always after our great example. As the song we sing, "He, the great example is, and pattern for me," and to pray Thy will be done.